little bit of time past the scheduled noon lunch hour to try to cover the three sets of topics that we did announce originally that we wanted to cover in open session. And certainly not to cut off any of the panel members who have some remarks and thoughts about how to lead the discussion on each of these topics that the panel wants to at least think about covering and how we might cover it. At that point, we'll go into, we'll have lunch, go into closed session, and although the schedule says 4:30 adjournment, as some of you have realized, we're collecting departure time so that we can get everybody taxied, and some people are leaving earlier, and the meeting will not go beyond 3:30.
We have two people more to leave before.
Yes. And with a little bit of luck, we'll end just a little bit before that. If there are any logistics, you should let one of the staff know, and we'll sort of get ourselves oriented. And in the afternoon, we're going to be joined by Paul, by telephone. John?
John will be on the telephone earlier today.
When we are ready.
Okay.
Okay, so I think we should patch John in.
Yeah, we should call John.
I certainly wouldn't have been up this early, and if I were in Chicago, it would be too early. Here it's all right, but it's not so true. Even though they're on here, but
and rationalize that they are. I know they have to visit relatives in New Zealand earlier in the 60s. And, you know, New Zealand was on the academy with their standards. But that's the state, isn't it?
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Hi, this is Cecilia Rusko at the Telegraph Union. Is it too early?
Pardon?
Is it too early to patch you in with a meeting?
No.
Okay, here we go.
John, welcome. It's Steve Feinberg.
How are you doing? Good morning to you all.
Can you hear? We're just trying to calibrate how loudly to speak for you.
Okay.
Oh, that sounds like you heard. So I'm not the right test case. Probably Pat Altham, who's beside me, is more. So I'll let her just say hello to test the sound, and then we'll just expect you to speak up if you have something to add to the table.
Okay.
Hello, John. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. So let me repeat where I was at before. We're now taking the agenda that was scheduled to run through 3 and trying to cover it this morning, likely running a little past noon, and we're going to begin with a discussion led by Richard Davison and Pat Gramsch on psychophysiology of emotion and deception. And we just take off, and I'm going to keep an eye open for panel members who want to intervene, and we'll try to keep this as informal as possible.
Good. Thank you. Hi, John.
Hi.
So what I'd like to do this morning is to organize these remarks in 7 sections. The first set of sections will have to do with the issues of autonomic specificity and emotion. I'll talk about some historical antecedents. I'll talk about the more modern era, where work has progressed to search for autonomic specificity. I'll talk about some critiques of that. Then I'd like to move on to the measures themselves that have historically been used in the polygraph: heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, and electrodermal activity, and talk in some more detail about those measures and what they mean biologically. And then move on to the topic of individual differences. Another topic related to individual differences, which I believe is pertinent to this whole issue, is the topic of emotion regulation, which is, I think, important for countermeasure issues. And then finally, I'm going to end with the brain. So that's kind of the organization. And I'll try to be very quick in going through this, and please stop me for clarification or elaboration at any point. In terms of the historical antecedents, they really can be traced back to William James, and most of you know that in his chapter on emotion in the Principles of Psychology in 1890, he articulated a theory which actually has become very influential and to this day, and essentially argued that our experience of emotion is the perception of bodily and autonomic changes. So, according to the James, and then it became known as the James Longa position, we experience fear because our heart is beating more strongly or more quickly, because we are running. So our fear is a secondary consequence of the bodily changes that are initiated.
When you were reading Paul's comment yesterday, I started to draw a causal diagram. You guys are going to watch me do this more than once. Unfortunately, every time somebody says something, I change where the arrows go. And I'm now going back to the diagram I drew yesterday, and I'm reversing one of the arrows because somewhere I had fear leading to something.
Well, this is what I'm giving you is the James position.
Well, I'm going to put two heads on it before I'm done.
Right.
Sure.
So, working around the time of William James at the same institution was Walter Cannon, who was across the river. Walter Cannon was working on the central biology of the brain, and one of the things that Cannon noticed is that when he stimulated with electrical stimulation in certain brain regions, it led to a cascade of changes in the body that then became known as sham rage. And this was an important observation and led to a reconsideration of the James Longa position and led to ideas of more undifferentiated arousal that were centrally controlled. Now, this concept of undifferentiated arousal as being a critical component of emotion and the specificity that distinguish among emotions arising from other sources was championed in the more modern era by Stanley Schachter and Jerome Singer. They published a very famous article in 1962 in the Psychological Review, which is still quoted in virtually every introductory psychology textbook. And what they did is they administered epinephrine to subjects, and in one condition, they misinformed subjects about the side effects of epinephrine. In another condition, they gave subjects realistic descriptions of what those side effects were. I'm not describing every condition of the experiment. And then they subjected subjects to social contexts that varied in their affective quality. In particular, there was one social context that was associated with actors behaving in a way designed to provoke anger, and in another context, they were behaving in a way designed to provoke happiness and and joy. And what Schachter and Singer claim is that the it was the combination of the epinephrine in the misinformed condition where subjects were given incorrect instructions about the source of their autonomic arousal that was combined with the information provided by the social context, which led to the specific emotion. One of the critical ideas to have emerged from the Schachter and Singer model was that the autonomic biology of emotion was not specific, that all emotions are accompanied by undifferentiated autonomic arousal, which in the Schachter and Singer experiment was experimentally produced by the administration of a drug, and the specific nature of the emotion was a, quote, cognitive interpretation or attribution which the subject made on the basis of the context in which he or she was placed. That was, and from that Schachter and Singer study, there was a, I think it's fair to say, a fairly pervasive influence for at least the next 20 years in the behavioral sciences, leading investigators to assume that, in fact, there was not autonomic differentiation that distinguished among different emotions, but rather all emotion is accompanied by this kind of undifferentiated autonomic arousal. It's actually interesting. One of the things, this is just in parentheses, one of the things I often do is give this article to my students and tell them to read it extremely carefully, that is the Schachter and Singer article, and tell me if their data really support their claims with regard to lack of autonomic differentiation among emotions. Most people forget the fact that Schachter and Singer actually did measure heart rate, and if you go back to their data, and I've actually reanalyzed their data, there are significant differences in heart rate between the anger and happiness conditions in the epinephrine misinformed group. And those data are in a table. They never discuss them, but they're actually available in the paper. But that's kind of a sidebar. In any case, there was a an independent stream of scholarly activity in the discipline of psychophysiology that on sort of first principles rejected the idea, the central idea of Schachter and Singer, and the psychophysiologists were operating on the assumption that there would be autonomic differentiation among certain emotions. And there's a whole list of studies that have been done using peripheral autonomic measures to search for differentiation among emotions. And this began with some classic studies of Albert Axe in the 1950s and then has continued to this day. Now, in the modern era, and now I'm talking about data that's been published within the last 20 years, there are a group of investigators, and Paul Ekman has been among them, who have searched for autonomic specificity and emotion. And I'd like to just very briefly review some of the central findings that have emerged from this literature. And by the way, I'd like to draw everyone's attention to the wonderful review article written by John Cassioppo that's in our readings. John beautifully reviews these data and comes to a conclusion which I completely agree with respect to these data. In terms of the replicated effects across various studies, it's been found that using measures of heart rate, that when anger, fear, and sadness are induced through a number of different methods, they produce reliable heart rate increases compared to the emotion of disgust. Fear produces reliable heart rate increases compared to happiness, as does anger, and fear tends to produce a higher heart rate compared to sadness. With diastolic blood pressure, anger produces a greater diastolic blood pressure than fear, and in general, anger has been found to have a more vascular response. It tends to produce vasoconstriction in the periphery, which drives up diastolic blood pressure. In general, and this is a conclusion that John Cacioppo reached in his review, and actually it was done as a meta-analysis, negative emotions across many studies tend to be associated with a stronger autonomic response than positive emotions, and there are a variety of speculations as to why that might be the case. And one of the things that I think is very important to keep in mind is why the autonomic system is there in the first place, and it's there to support the metabolic demands of the body. Emotions often involve action disposition, and to the extent that there are specific action sequelae associated with different emotions, one would expect that there should be autonomic accompaniments that that distribute the blood supply in a way that maximizes a specific action that is associated with an emotion. Now, with respect to this modern evidence, it still remains controversial, and whether these data can be taken to support the idea that there are discrete autonomic signatures, so to speak, for different discrete emotions is something that I think most biobehavioral scientists, particularly those who are focused more on studying the brain, would regard with some suspicion. The source of the evidence for autonomic specificity is varied. Some of it is based on a task that was developed by Paul Ekman, which at the next meeting, Paul will have to show you himself because he's such a facial athlete that it's just wonderful to see him do this. But it's a task that involves instructing people to move their face in a specific configuration by giving them muscle-by-muscle instructions. So the emotion words are never used. What a subject is instructed to do is to configure his or her face in a specific way on the basis of muscle-by-muscle instructions. When the correct configuration, according to a theoretical prototype, is evidenced on the face, the subject is instructed to hold the face in that configuration for a certain duration of time, typically about 20 seconds, and then autonomic activity is recorded. And a good amount of the recent evidence for autonomic specificity in emotion is based upon that task. Now, one of the things you should know about that task is that many subjects, when they do that, don't report feeling the accompanying emotion. So that when you ask them to move their muscles in a configuration that resembles fear, for example, they don't necessarily record experiencing fear, and there's some data that's been published in the literature which argues that some of these effects, at least, are a function of the effort required to configure the face in these particular patterns. Some muscle movements on the face are a lot more difficult than other muscle movements, so all of us can easily move our zygomatic major muscle and bring the lip corners up, but moving the corrugator muscle and the frontalis muscle, I can't do it, and I don't even want to try because we'll have the master here soon. But those muscles are more difficult to move, and if you just query people using a crude self-report measure, you'll find that people report that they, in fact, require more effort to do their other movements. So there's some concern that some of these effects are, in fact, associated with effort per se. Now, the modern work on autonomic specificity and emotion is based upon, at least implicitly and in some cases explicitly, on a theory that was very influential and has influenced people like Paul Ekman, and it's a theory that was developed by Sylvan Thompson in the late 1960s, and it can be simply summarized in the following way. Thompson had a notion of an affect program, It's a hypothetical module in the mind, and that when an emotion is elicited through any method, it will activate an affect program, and the program will then orchestrate a cascade of responses that would be invariant across the various contextual and situational domains in which that emotion might be evoked. So according to this model, the fear that you might experience when you go to a doctor's office waiting for the diagnosis of a potentially life-threatening disease would be putatively the same as the fear you experience when you're walking in a dark alley at night and hear strange noises. Now, whether those two states are really the same or not, I think is a very important and an empirical question, and I don't believe we really know the answer to it. But those who adopt a view of autonomic specificity and emotion have implicitly assumed that however emotion is evoked, it's going to produce a very similar cascade of autonomic change, and we don't know whether that's true or not. Certainly when one thinks about the brain, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that, in fact, states like that may really be different. Furthermore, we know that there are different action patterns associated with the same emotion. So taking fear as a continuing example, we know from work in animals as well as work in humans that there are that one response to fear of several is to freeze. And there's a lot of data in animals showing freezing behavior in response to threat. There are also contexts in which an animal will flee during a fear stage. And the autonomic changes that you see that precede or accompany freezing versus fleeing are different. It would be unreasonable to assume that we're going to see the same autonomic signature across these different instantiations of, for example, fear when they are associated with these different patterns of action. So, let me talk a little bit about the measures themselves. John, you might want to chime in here. The measures that have historically been used in the polygraph for heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, and electrodermal activity. And with the exception of electrodermal activity, three out of the other three measures all are dually innervated by both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. For example, just taking heart rate, the same magnitude heart rate change in either direction can be associated with either a change in sympathetic, a change in parasympathetic, or a change in both sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system activity. So there could be an identical...
Can you just say a few words about parasympathetic, sympathetic?
Sure. For example, with respect to heart rate, we know that the heart is innervated both sympathetically and parasympathetically, and it's possible to produce an increase in heart rate by an increase in sympathetic activity. It's possible to produce an increase in heart rate by decreasing the parasympathetic influence on the heart, and it's possible to produce the same magnitude increase through some combination of both. One of the things that John has done in his work is to show that there are cases where those branches are relatively orthogonal, you can get a situation where sympathetic and parasympathetic activity both go up, where they both go down, or where they're reciprocally related. By using an index like heart rate itself, we don't know what the underlying neural innervation to the heart is, although I should say at this point that there are peripheral autonomic measures which would allow us to disentangle these contributions that are being used today extensively in the psychophysiological literature. But from heart rate itself, we can't make that inference. I should also mention that a response as seemingly simple as electrodermal activity, it turns out that when you look at its biology, it turns out to be much more complex. The pseudomotor gland, the sweat gland, is cholinergically innervated, but it turns out that the gland, the sweat duct goes up through the different layers of the skin of the epidermis, and there are myothelial cells, which are smooth muscles, that surround the sweat gland, and those myothelial cells are adrenergically innervated. Skin conductance level may be more a function of the cholinergic input to the pseudomotor gland, whereas spontaneous responses may be more associated with the smooth muscle contractions around the sweat gland, which turn out to be adrenergically mediated. There's a whole extensive scientific literature on this, and I just mention it to call attention to the fact that the biology of these systems is complex, and the way these responses, I think, are measured in a lot of the literature that we've seen does not take advantage of the potential signals that can be extracted from these indices. So even using the measures as they are currently used, there are things that we can do on the post-processing side to extract information that is currently not being extracted.
Richie, just a common sense question. On the sweat gland, sometimes I'll be nervous, and then 5-10 seconds later, I start to sweat. And so the question came up on a polygraph that really bothered me. I guess my common sense would suggest that I wouldn't start sweating for 5 or 10 seconds.
Well, that's an important observation, and it is a very time-lagged response, so that there is a long latency to show a response, and it's also not a very precisely time-locked latency. There's a lot of variability across individuals and even within an individual as to the latency to the peak of the response from a critical emotional event, for example. It's unlike for those who might be familiar with event-related potentials in the brain or hemodynamic signals in the brain, where you have a much tighter temporal coupling between the presentation of an event and the measurement of the peak of the response. Okay. So now let me turn to the topic of individual differences. Individual differences is an extremely important area. A lot of my own research actually has focused on the topic of individual differences. And let me just say that there are that personality differences, as they're reflected in classical self-report measures, have been correlated with a variety of physiological measures of the sort that are being measured in the polygraph, as well as with many other kinds of measures. I should also say that there are individual differences that are statistically reliable in the physiological measures themselves. And there has been, there are a number of people in the scientific literature who have applied the same kind of psychometric criteria that we would apply, for example, to test construction, where we evaluate internal consistency reliability and other metrics of reliability. There are scientists who have applied those same statistics to physiological measures themselves. If a physiological measure is going to be used as a trait-like index, there are some who have argued that it's imperative to demonstrate that they have appropriate reliability in a formal sense, have applied those kinds of statistical methods to the biological measures. And it turns out that some of these measures are satisfy the criteria that we want for statistical reliability, and others don't. and, you know, it varies across different measures. But for the ones that do show this kind of reliability, there is some reason to believe that individual differences that are reliable in this way will affect a person's pattern of responsivity to certain kinds of emotional challenges. And let me just, I'll give some examples later when I get to the brain, but this work has led to a new way of thinking about individual differences where we can parse individual differences on the basis of biological indices, where the individual differences essentially are honoring the distinctions that are being made by the brain, and then examining the nomological network of associations based upon those reliable brain-based individual differences. Using that kind of strategy, we may not find that individual differences are parsed on according to the big five personality types or according to, you know, the temperament dimensions that really can be traced back to, you know, Carl Jung and before. That's where all that stuff has come from. I think there's a new way to approach individual differences, and there's a lot of data out there that is relevant to this issue. Let me turn to the topic of emotion regulation and tell you why I think it's relevant to issues that we've been talking about with the polygraph. Let me just define emotion regulation first. Emotion regulation is a phrase that is bandied about in the behavioral sciences, I think, rather imprecisely in most contexts, but in a very simple way, we can define it as mechanisms, either automatic or controlled, that are utilized by an individual to either attenuate, accentuate, or maintain an emotional response that's present. So they are various kinds of mechanisms that influence an ongoing emotional response. And obviously, mechanisms that may allow us to decrease an emotional response, particularly to a putatively fear-inducing or stressful stimulus, may be relevant to countermeasures and to individual differences in the behavior of an individual in a polygraph setting. Now, it turns out that there are reliable individual differences on certain biological measures that reflect the capacity for emotion regulation, specifically for attenuating negative emotional responses. Some people are good at it, some people are bad at it, and those differences are statistically reliable. They show very good test-retest reliability, and they show very good internal consistency reliability. That would lead one to hypothesize that those individuals who are particularly adept at attenuating negative emotion voluntarily may be those individuals who are less likely, who are better able to influence the polygraph.
Are there well-understood correlates of those individual differences that would allow you to predict?
I wouldn't say that they're, I think it would be irresponsible to say that they're well understood. I think that we're beginning to understand them, and there's a lot of new brain imaging work that's focused on those issues. Mark can speak to that. And, you know, I think that we're beginning to understand them. I certainly don't think it's at a stage of tremendous maturity. We can articulate a theory about how this works, and there are some data which
maybe even two theories.
Yeah.
Or three.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me just end with the brain, and I'm not going to spend much time. I'm sure Mark will have more to say, but it should. You know, no one needs any reminder that the controls for the autonomic nervous system are in the brain. And all of this is ultimately controlled by the brain, and if we're interested in getting better measures, then it may behoove us to look in a more direct fashion at the brain itself. There is an yesterday we talked a little bit about the theory that has been articulated as being the theory underlying the polygraph, which is the fear of detection as the critical process which is being reflected in the indices that are being recorded. And we know, if there's one emotion that we know about as neuroscientists, it's the emotion of fear. And we were talking last night over dinner, I think, you know, most neuroscientists who know anything about this literature would agree with that statement. That's not a controversial statement, that we know much more about fear than we do about any other emotion. There's an extremely large corpus of research at the animal level that has helped us trace the circuitry in very detailed ways. People like Joe Ledoux and Mike Davis have made seminal contributions to our understanding of this area. And we know, for example, that the amygdala, which is a small structure buried within the medial temporal lobe of the brain, plays an important role in fear, and it's critical for fear conditioning, learning about fearful things. And we know that we can measure activation in the amygdala with new techniques like functional MRI. And just to give you one example that puts the individual difference issue together with the brain, we can predict on the basis of the signal that we get using functional MRI from the amygdala, in response to a negative emotional stimulus, the amount of dispositional negative affect that a person reports in his or her everyday life fairly robustly. There are individual differences in the magnitude of signal that you can record from the amygdala. Some people, in response to the same stimulus, show a big signal. Other people show a much weaker signal. It turns out that those differences are reliable, and they also predict attributes of an individual's behavior in a way which, based upon just this one single measure, is quite substantial in terms of effect size. We're talking here about a correlation of around 0.65. It's also known that these signals in the amygdala are incredibly sensitive to very weak signals of fear. And so, for example, there are good data published in the literature showing that you can take a fear facial expression and you can mask it using the backward masking paradigm with a neutral face, so that the phenomenological experience of the subject is that all she or he sees is a neutral face. The fear face is presented for 33 milliseconds, the neutral face is presented for 100 milliseconds, and the neutral face is contiguous with the fear face. So all you see phenomenologically is that neutral face. Well, it turns out that functional MRI measurements of the signal in the amygdala are able to detect whether the fear face preceded that neutral face or whether a happy face preceded that neutral face, even though the subject reports that all they ever saw was a neutral face. They never saw a fear or a happy face. And so using backward masking techniques with these extremely weak and consciously not recognized signals, the signal in the amygdala is able to make that differentiation. I think that there is a lot of potential for these new technologies if we were interested in exploring them, and this is where all the action is controlled anyway. So let me end here.
And that's the way the brain operates for sure. Is there a baseline that's developed? So if I go to a screening interview and I'm afraid that my career could be over in an hour, so I have fear already, and I also fear that I committed espionage, and that's why my career is going to be over, I'm going to get caught. And then the question is asked, would you expect a spike in the amygdala at that point?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I don't think we really know the answer to that, because it requires looking at the relation between baseline levels of activity, or activity in the prior period, and a subsequent reaction to a specific stimulus. And those kind of data are not really available at this point in time. I mean, it is a tractable question. But it has not
right.
been.
Certainly, the data we have suggests you could approach that kind of a question with a scientifically well-designed experiment. Probably worth doing.
If we were talking about polygraph, and we are just talking about the basic research that goes on in this area, what you're anxious to do, when you say reliable and measurable and different, it's consistently detectable. And if you thought about the kind of screening uses of those tools for something, forget about polygraph, and thought about administering them if it were physically and financially feasible to thousands of people, you need very high levels of predictive.
Mm-hmm.
How are we talking that kind of predictive?
I don't think anybody knows. I mean,
so that's where the real speculation is.
I think part of the issue is taking, for example, the modern imaging techniques here. They, of course, began with studies across people. And so and this was certainly true in the PET era. There would be no hope of probably doing the kind of sophisticated things that Richie was talking about, simply because you had to have multiple people to know you had a response. The fMRI business has changed that substantially in that you can get an enormous amount of information on a single individual. You can also garner it for each event that's presented to that individual. Now, the question would be, how reliable is that for that individual as compared to another? And I think that's an open question at the moment. But it's one I think it will be addressed out of the context of this meeting. It will be addressed because people are definitely interested in this whole issue of individual differences. So this is actually already being looked at.
And this is talking about something quite separate from what individual differences might mean in a polygraph kind of environment.
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, well, we had quite a discussion last night. In fact, I've had two different conversations about personality and individual differences, because anybody who looks carefully at these kinds of data coming out of fMRI now can't help but be struck by the fact that there are individual differences here. And the question is, what are they related to? I mean, what measures of this person, either at that moment or over long periods of time, are relevant to an interpretation of that, and many, including me, would really love to know how to get at that question. I think it's exceedingly important and interesting problem.
And then the confounding issue is the fact that the label individual difference is used for both. Common language label describe personality dispositions as well as reliable empirical individual differences, in this case in the brain or in the physio. And there's some obfuscation there that we have to be very, very careful of.
It sounds like, though, in relation to Steve's question, the levels of effects that you're seeing are certainly impressive in a socio-behavioral context, but are not high enough at this point to be useful diagnostic context, but that by varying conditions and further experimentation, it's quite conceivable that you would be able to find stimuli and or sequences of stimuli and conditions that would raise them up maybe a lot.
And we don't know what the diagnostic up.
Well, presumably we would. You know.
Yeah, we could. Yeah.
So the fact that they may lead to differences in the physiology that might in fact interact with differences in the protocol, for example, between control and relevant questions, meaning that there may well be some variance that can be explained by those that can be removed from noise.
Anybody ever looked at repeat polygraphs on the same subject with different examiners blinded to the results?
I had the same question. Most of the repetition, it seems, with polygraph testing is within session.
Right. And within session is very different from a week later.
Exactly. And I'm going to address a little bit of that and some reason to suspect that that could be the case, just with the examinee, not to mention differences, of course, in the examiner and across examiners, et cetera.
Would it be a training effect?
All sorts of effects on it.
Yeah. We had the PEC ramps listed in the session. I don't know if there was anything you wanted to add or comment on. And then I want to turn to Jim because he's ready to tell us the other side of some of this in some sense, which is social factors.
I said two concerns, and one was kind of been addressed. I'm doing it. As I see it, what's going on with the polygraph is a differential measurement that has to appear. So you're trying to compare your responses to different questions. And it's not clear to me from the research that's been presented that there's a firm scientific background for something that subtle. But yet it seems to work. That's concern one. And concern two is they're closely related to the issue of individual differences and countermeasures. And I can't help but wonder about the relevance of research on normal reactivity as applied to trained espionage agents. What can they do? I'm assuming it's more than just these, well, bite your tongue or count backwards by sevens and 200. I am assuming that here is a technology which has been in existence and well known and well studied for something like 80 years now. And, you know, so there's been time for experienced, intelligent individuals to develop a whole strong set of countermeasures. So how relevant is all this to someone who is, well-prepared and very differentially motivated now to deal with this situation? So those are just two questions which I don't have the answers. I don't even know whether or not there are answers.